Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Religion Matters podcast. To introduce ourselves, my name is Alex Beasley, and I'm a religion major as well as a NBB major here at the college.
My name is Noah Lee. I'm studying chemistry and a joint major in philosophy and religion.
My name is Jane Shia, and I'm double majoring in biology and religion here at Emory University. And we are all currently taking the Religion Major Senior Symposium. So for a final project, we were empowered to bring the conversation about religion to the public sphere and decided to make this podcast. And what brought the three of us together is an interest in the intersection between religion and healing. So one topic that we found very interesting and relevant was addiction and the role that belief in a higher power plays in recovery.
To discuss religion and addiction, we're so happy to welcome Faye Zenoff as our guest. She's currently the Vice President of Partnerships at Work at Health, a woman-founded and women-run organization that provides treatment for people in recovery from addiction across the country. She also has worked as a recovery consultant and as a director of Open Recovery, where she fought to end the stigma around addiction. Thank you so much. Without further ado.
Okay. Hey, everyone. Good to be here with you, Faye.
Thank you.
My name is Noah. I'm a senior at Emory.
And my name is Alex. I'm also a senior at Emory.
Faye, we're so grateful to be here with you. Thank you for your time. You just got promoted to... Can you remind us your title?
Yes. So I am the Vice President of Partnerships at Work at Health.
We're going to get into a little bit more about what you do at Work at Health in just a minute.
Okay.
But... our first question is, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself in a 5-minute nutshell and tell us a little bit about your story.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I often do workshops at treatment centers where I work with people who are recovering from addiction. And when I do this piece of my introduction, I tell them I can share who I am by my external credentials. I have an MBA from Northwestern. I have an undergraduate degree from Sarah Lawrence College. I've worked in the public and private sector, a career of 25 plus years. Or I can introduce myself and qualify as a peer, as I'm a person in long-term recovery from a substance use disorder. And I definitely have comorbid issues, which means I also struggle and suffer from other mental health or behavioral health issues such as depression. So I professionally today, I work in the field of addiction and recovery as an advocate and a consultant and educator. I call myself a recovery strategist because it really depends on whom I'm working with to see what their needs are. And I work to destigmatize addiction and recovery.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much. So I know it's one thing, it's very common now for everyone to deal with a little bit of their own, you know, mental health, challenges. But what was it that kind of spoke to you that you wanted to make, you know, addiction and recovery, that business, something that you work full time in?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I would say, I was somebody who was very high functioning even when I was in the throes of my addiction. I'm privileged. I came from a family that valued education and success in the world. And so I learned how to achieve enough so that I had the accolades of the people that I cared about. And therefore, I was able to deny and cover where I was struggling. And I was often searching for approval in my career. So even if I was working in the nonprofit sector, I was still seeking for myself to know that I was enough. Once I got into recovery, I realized that I wanted to be of service to other people. And so that's, I think, just out of growth and maturity, but also that I wanted to help other people find the solutions that I found, but within the workplace. The majority of people who are struggling with a substance use disorder, 70% are gainfully employed. We're not people on the streets, even though there are plenty of unhoused people on the streets who struggle with mental health issues and substance use. I would say about nearly 10 years ago, made a turn. I had been working in financial services. I had worked in tech. I had worked in education, but I made the turn to focus solely on addiction and recovery. Did that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Thank you so much.
I wanted, when you asked me to introduce myself, I also wanted to share, you asked about my story, and I didn't share anything about my story per se. And oftentimes in recovery circles, we tell our stories by what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And so I just want to, without using our time to tell my story, I just want to say that as a child, I had some traumatic experiences that did not make me an alcoholic, but I did not treat the trauma. And so later, when I was uncomfortable, I reached for alcohol and drugs to change my inner experience. And that worked as my solution. That did not make me an alcoholic or an addict. It was something that happened in my brain where I was unable to manage what was happening and how the alcohol and drugs affected me. And I didn't have an off switch. And so point along the line of my use, I became, you know, the alcohol and drugs owned me. I no longer had choice. But as I mentioned before, because I was high functioning, I was able to graduate college, have jobs, have successful relationships, and that's in parens or quotes, get a graduate degree, have children, and I was able to fully function. So only after I got sober and got into recovery was I able to truly deal with the trauma of my childhood. And that's part of the healing. And that's why I stand so much for getting the alcohol and drugs out of our system so we can deal with and learn the skills to have a healthy and happy life.
Thanks, Faye. I wanted to validate what you're saying. One thing that you taught me that sticks with me is that we're all in recovery from something. And you talked about these comorbid issues. I'm getting the sense that what you're going through also can be applied to so many people within and beyond the context of alcoholism. So thanks for your wisdom.
I truly believe that so many of us feel a certain kind of emptiness inside, and we try to fill that up with purpose or with relationships or adrenaline or alcohol. We are searching. We are searching to feel whole. And some of the things we put into us can cause addiction and can cause us harm and others harm. Like, I mean, it could be video games, it could be gambling, it could be a whole variety of things. It's not just alcohol and drugs, but that happened to be part of my story.
For sure. Another part of your story that we wanted to plug is your podcast, Some of My Imperfections. And just wanted to hear briefly about what that experience was like for you to make that, what came out of it for you personally. Just some reflections.
Oh, thank you. So what I was interested in doing in my podcast was talking to people who are in recovery, who have been able to use that platform to do incredible things in this life for other people. So it's not so much focused on how'd you get sober, what was it like when you were using, but much more about, wow, you're in recovery and you started a Fortune 500 company. Oh, wait a minute. You're in recovery and you ran for public office. There are so many examples of people who crash and burn and not enough examples of people who rise and then rebuild and then go on to do great things. So I love the podcast. We have 8 episodes to date. And then I paused once I started working for Work at Health to, you know, dive in fully to my new role. But I am open to continuing with talking to extraordinary people in recovery.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's amazing. I've listened to a couple of your episodes and I think it's really fantastic. You know, everyone has their story. And like you said, kind of giving people the, you know, the example to look up to, like this can happen. You know, your life isn't over if you are struggling with something, I think is just amazing.
Alex, I totally agree. I want to say that when I was your age, when I was in college, I particularly was struggling as a senior in college. I went into great depression. I could not imagine that this is it. I go on to being this adult and I couldn't imagine. I was struggling. I was deep into my use and I had no role models. I didn't know anybody in recovery. And so that is something I'm grateful for. That seems to have changed in our culture. So luckily, and for people like you who are doing this, they are normalizing and giving voice to something that might have been mysterious before.
Thank you again for that.
That's resonant. I just want to like, if there's like a way for me to just say resonant, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And I think it's something, you know, so many of us would benefit from, you know, hearing those great examples. But now to kind of change things up a little bit, we kind of want to dive in to some of your work. So can you start with kind of a sweeping overview? For example, someone reaches out to you through your company and reports, you know, struggling with alcoholism for, say, 5 years now. Can you walk us through that overall process of how you're going to support this person through their journey?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So if they were to reach out to us through Work It Health, that would be they would go online, maybe they would download the app, and then there would be a series of questions that they could answer to identify their habits and their behaviors and their thinking as it relates to their use of substances. And then it also gives us an opportunity to ask what one is looking for. So you fill out a questionnaire of sorts, and then you have an opportunity to choose what kind of program or what kind of support you want. So through our organization, for example, perhaps you just want coaching, or you want to deal with a counselor, or you want to talk to a medical provider and do a whole diagnostic because there might be other issues going on, not just the substance use disorder. So based on what it is you're seeking, once you do your self-exploration and identify what you identify as your primary issue, you then have options of what kind of program you would want. Based on what you choose, you could get supports or interventions all on your telephone. That can all be done on your phone. You could set up appointments also through your phone to meet with counselors and take programs. You could get into groups, like group support with other people in your area. You could get access to one of our clinics to go in and have a physical if that's of interest to you, or meet a provider. And then every individual will get an opportunity to participate in designing what recovery looks like for them. The components that we offer are online courses. So some of them can be just like, stop, let's do a gut check. Are you making healthy decisions right now? You know, how are you sleeping? How are you eating? How are you communicating? And we'll look at different components of your wellness. Is it your physical wellness? Is it your financial wellness? Is it your environmental health? So we'll broaden the understanding of wellness, not just to be how I feel or my behavior in a certain area. And we'll give you the option to work on those different parts of yourself. And again, it can be a combination of in groups, one-on-one, with the help of medication if that's needed. If you have an opioid use disorder and you want Suboxone to help get you off that medication. So you will get then the support from us to have a program of recovery that can complement anything else you're doing and can be as discreet or as overt as works for you. And so some people check in multiple times a week. Some people only check in once a week. Some people check in once a month. So it really depends on the level of engagement that you want and that works for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fantastic. You know, a lot of times I think a problem really arises from people not knowing what their resources are when they come through these things. So yeah, thank you so much for laying those out.
Yeah, and I want to tell you too that we partner with other organizations. So if we're not able to provide the support someone needs, we will help them find in their own community referral sources that we can help them with. We also do all kinds of education. One of the cool things the co-founders of this organization, women founded and led and right now privately funded, they wanted to democratize treatment, access to treatment, because as you may know, there's this huge inequity in our country, not only because of stigma, and so a lot of people don't come forward or there isn't education about it, but also just because of where you happen to be born or what color your skin is, that will indicate the likelihood that you're either going to go to jail or you can go to treatment or you can just carry on and ignore it. So I love the mission of this organization, and by having it all accessible on through technology, we can reach people in rural communities. We can reach people all across the country.
I have a follow-up professional question. Your previous work emphasized destigmatizing addiction and recovery.
Yes.
And this seems like the focus is more on people's personalized individual journeys through recovery.
Yeah.
But without, you know, I just want to hear your feelings about that kind of shift in mentality and how that makes you feel about your work.
Okay, if I understand the question, let me say that I have always believed that the path to recovery and the journey in recovery is as personal and personalized as the individual themselves. There is no one path. And I think to our conversation about God, just like there is no one path to have a relationship with God or to nirvana or to freedom. Excuse me. One of the things that I really also have always believed in is that recovery is not necessarily synonymous with abstinence or with AA. That there are some assumptions that if you are in recovery, you abstain from everything. Well, that might not be the case, that there is harm reduction models of recovery where we say, well, I'm going to make sure that I'm no longer drinking alcohol, but I'm still smoking cigarettes. Well, smoking cigarettes is another form of drug use and of harm. So it's like, well, I'm not going to tackle everything in my life right now, but we're going to do it in order of, and I usually say, let's focus on the order of what's going to kill you, right? So it's a progress and it's an evolution. So what I really appreciate is when I was working before in the nonprofit in San Francisco, it was very much about educating people to end stigma and eliminate stigma and shame. What I'm working on now is much more about access to care wherever you are, your timing, your pace, your program. My role has changed, obviously. I used to work, and I still sometimes do, I work with the individual in recovery as a peer. And I do coaching for families and individuals. In the organization of Work at Health, what I do is I try to build partnerships with employers and companies as well as referral sources just to increase the culture of recovery. And so we can cross-refer and make sure people get help.
Thanks, Faye. Yeah, and you're working across the whole gamut of things from the level of the individual to the level of corporation.
Yes.
You know, how can we make sure that we end stigma and employ people and
that's right.
Take care of our people. So Alex and I were particularly interested in this conversation about God, as you alluded to. We know that God of my understanding, appears in the 12 steps. We're going to talk about the Serenity Prayer in a little bit. And we're curious about your individual experience through recovery, about your relationship with God. So wanted to start with a few questions. Do you believe in God? And if you do or do not, what kind of role does God have in your life?
Yeah, I do believe in God. And of course, a God of my understanding, I was brought up in a Jewish family where God played a role. We talked about God. We had a prayer before dinner where we thanked God for our blessings. I went to religious school, Sunday school, and we prayed to God. And so I always had an understanding that there is a God and that the God is, well, how I'm going to define God. I think that it was that there was this, that there is a belief that there is a higher purpose, there is a higher meaning than what my individual comprehension can behold and understand. But it had to do with goodness, and it had to do with grace, and it had to do with peace. And so if I could align myself and my actions with harmony, then I knew I was doing God's work, or I knew that I was doing the right thing. So I always believed in God, and I prayed to God, as I shared, but I never, when it came to solution finding around my alcoholism, I never looked to God, because I looked to myself because I was so highly capable. So, you know what? I'll drink this amount. I won't drink this amount. I will lose some weight. I'll move a job. I'll change a relationship. That will manage it. I looked to manage my problems myself. And it was only right before I was 40 years old, I started using when I was probably 14, something like that, did I actually fall to my knees and pray and ask God and surrender. I can't do it. I've proven that I can't do it. I felt insane because I was always so capable. And this insanity of the disease scared me. And so when I prayed on my knees for help, I had a knowing that I needed to get into recovery. And I had tried for years to do anything I could. I did not want to go to recovery. I understood recovery as the end of fun, where losers go, a place of sad people. And I found the contrary. I found the contrary. So in recovery, I have often heard many, many prayers said that are not prayers I was familiar with, because they were mostly Christian prayers. And yet they were beautiful. And so I allowed myself from a spiritual place to participate in this prayer, not from a religious place. And through recovery, I began to understand spirituality as opposed to religious belief. And I continue to be proudly Jewish. I continue to have a relationship with my God. And in my recovery practice, I have cultivated a meditation practice and a prayer practice that has expanded and deepened my relationship and my ability to hear and receive and find peace, which I didn't have before.
Wow. First of all.
Yeah. Thank you. That was, that was amazing. There's so many things that I kind of want to go back and kind of hash out a little bit further. So you mentioned that, your Jewish upbringing.
Yes.
You had a relationship with God. I'm kind of curious to see how that relationship, can you explain a little bit how that acts in your work? I'm sure, with a bunch of different people coming in from, so many different backgrounds, is there a tension with, I believe in God as well. I don't believe in God. I might believe in a different God, things like that. And how does that manifest itself? Through your everyday work life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've never quite thought about it. I think one of the things we do in this country, as you know, is we have this, distinct separation between church and state. And so I find that there is a separation between professional life and church, if you will. And so in my work professionally, I would say religion and God has not played a part overtly. We kind of approach everything very agnostically, humanistically. However, there is room for one to bring God in if they choose to. I want to say that one of the things that I do as a woman in recovery is I sponsor other women. And what that means, it's like volunteer work. And there I share, I give away how I got into recovery, what steps I took, what path I took, what lessons I've learned. And the promise is, if you do what I've done, you'll get what I got. So I absolutely, in that case, bring God into it. Because I talk about every morning, I get on my knees. Now, Jews, we don't get on our knees. I mean, once a year, maybe. But I get on my knees. For me, it's a reminder. It's a humbling, not a humiliating, but a humbling reminder that I pray to do the right thing on this day, that I have purpose. So I get on my knees and I pray in the morning. I did not grow up doing that. And I love it. It's just right. It right sizes me because I used to just bound out of bed with all the things I needed to do. An occupation doesn't necessarily have to be professional. It doesn't have to be, one doesn't need to be paid for it. So I do think of one's service. And in this case, the role of God is important to me in my service to other people. So if I share what I do each day to stay grounded and centered as a woman in recovery, I share, like, I'll start my day with prayer. I will end my day with gratitude. And what that looks like is that my wife and I will write a list of at least 10 things that we're grateful for on this particular day. And the majority of those things were given to us. We didn't earn them. We didn't create them. And so once again, God plays a role there as well. So I think that would explain. So in my professional life where I'm paid professionally, we don't talk of God very much unless the individual that we're working with wants to bring that in, and they're welcome to. But in my volunteer work around recovery, I certainly do.
I see. Yeah, that's super enlightening, with the secular nature of kind of the world today. And I don't want to put like words in your mouth at all, so I'll obviously give you a chance to respond. But it sounds kind of like there's a way to keep in touch with a spiritual side without, you know, objectively like putting the label God on it. Is that kind of how you see that influence?
Yeah, I think that's I think that's perfectly on target. That I think the word God scares a lot of people, turns off a lot of people, and spirituality and higher purpose or whatever the terminology is, oneness, nature, allows everybody to engage to finding peace without having to buy into doctrine of a specific religion if that doesn't work for them. So it's a way to create more connection, I think, regardless, you know, whereas in religion we have some separateness.
Sure. I'm going to ask you to unpack this a little more. Alex and I are religion students in our last year, and we've talked a lot about what is religion. We have one professor who talks about football as religion, celebrity worship as religion, et cetera, et cetera. And I so admire and thank you for sharing about your morning rituals and your daily practices of like instilling spirituality in your life. I guess my question is, where do you draw the line? Does that feel like a religious experience for you? You're experiencing spirituality. So how do you differentiate those things? I know you mentioned doctrines. So I'd love to hear.
Okay. So first of all, let me, be sure to say my disclaimer is I am not a religious studies student. And so I don't have access to that, expertise that you guys have. Religion for me, as it relates to, and I'm somebody who loves to light candles on Friday night, loves to bake a challah on Friday, loves to celebrate the high holidays when they come, proudly Jewish, as I said. For me, religion has to do with my heritage, that I come from a people with a practice, and my hope is that my great-grandchildren will continue that who I am as an individual, my story, my name is not that important because I'm part of a Jewish heritage and people. Religion plays a part of that heritage.
It's just so deep because you were talking about surrendering to, like, I am not everything as an individual. I need to surrender to being in recovery because there are forces out there that are greater. And then hearing you talk about your religion and your heritage, what that means for you is a surrender to something greater than yourself, which in this case is your people. In that case was
No, it's really a
God.
Great point. I've never thought about it, but I do believe it is the I, it is the ego, it is that gets in the way of my experiencing peace because it's so much based on fear and lack. So when I am in spirituality each day, it is so that I stay grounded as a person in recovery and make healthy choices. when I am, and first of all, I am only a woman in recovery if I, and I'm just thinking about this now for the first time, so this is very interesting to me. No matter what I do, I am Jewish. No matter if I believe or don't believe, I am Jewish. No matter if I light candles or not, I am Jewish. If I were not to do my morning prayers, not to do my gratitude list, let's say I started drinking again, I would not be spiritual. I don't need to practice religion to be proudly identified in my religion and still be considered a person of my religion. Does that make sense? But if I don't practice spirituality, I will not be spiritual, right? I don't have to practice my Judaism to be Jewish, though it enriches it if I do.
It seems like what you're describing as your spiritual practices are about attunement and mindfulness to the things that are going to keep you grounded as a person on this path and that are good for you.
Right, in this lifetime,
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you took the time to kind of explain that, because for me, my background, I grew up Christian, went through Catholic schooling systems. So I really didn't know that there could be that separation. You know, if there are kids in my class who were in a Christian household and they said they don't believe in God, you know, they weren't Christian anymore to us. So I think it's really fascinating to kind of get that perspective, the different perspective from Judaism and how, you know, we can't always think about all religions in the same exact way.
Well, I have learned from people in recovery who grew up, let's say, and I'm not going to pick on one religion, but I've just, you know, grew up Catholic is what I've heard, is that they were brought up with a God of punishment. And only in recovery have they been able to find a God of love, because we have this opportunity to have a God of our understanding, which was not something they were brought up with. And nor was I brought up with a God of my understanding. There was God of Abraham, Moses, you know. So, I think spirituality has allowed me to understand that we can all be connected, no matter what household we were brought in, what faith we were brought up in.
Wow. Thank you. And I just especially appreciate you sharing about God of love, because that can exist. And I think that from other conversations that we've had in preparation for this project, that feels like a beautiful theme. So I'm just glad you put those words to it. We wanted to ask you also about your Shabbat tables, and I'm so grateful that I've, you know, shared that with your beautiful family and our shared love for Victoria. Most Shabbat tables, wine is kind of the central piece of the meal. It's the, you know, put it in this big ornate cup, which you have, but you fill it with grapes. And so, you know, a much larger point is that alcohol plays a critical part in religious events, and wanted to hear about your experience. What is that like for you through the lens of an alcoholic?
You know, it depends on where I was on my journey. The holiday of Passover is coming up, and during the course of that Seder, that evening, we go through a ritual of telling a story. And during that, we have these moments where we are to raise and drink, I think it's 4 glasses of wine. And I remember early on being having a lot of trepidation about how am I not going to drink, because the lure of drink was so strong for me. But then how do I participate if I'm not drinking? And, you know, what I was able to understand is the symbolism of the drink. And that's what the grapes do for me, which is I still have the symbol of the grape, which with the help of God, it becomes fermented and gives us this elixir for joy and relaxation. So how is wine used in our tradition to celebrate our freedom, to make something holy, to acknowledge the joy of life? Well, I can do that still without actually pouring that substance into me. So I can say what, you know, on the holiday of Purim, it's almost suggested that you should get drunk with alcohol to celebrate that holiday. But I can get drunk on happiness, and I can get drunk on connections, and I can get drunk. So what does it mean to get drunk? You know, and it's like understanding what the message and the meaning is, then I can reinterpret it in a way that's healthy for me. I mean, we had to do that as Jews because we used to do sacrifices, right? So we have to modernize it so that it makes sense in our world today.
Right on. I'm so glad you made that connection. That's super cool. Wow, yeah. that's the whole religion as we know it today is right. Like reinterpreting that's it right. To what works for our time.
That's right.
And clearly, like, pouring substance into your body doesn't work for you at this time. And that right. Just to hear you flip that on its head was super cool.
Well, what's so interesting to me is, especially today, there's so many people we care so much about our environment, as we should care about our vessels, our bodies, as we should. And we talk about leaving zero, you know, carbon footprint and only eating organic food. And yet we pour alcohol into our system. And the ingredient that makes alcohol effective is the number one ingredient in jet fuel. Ethanol. It is the number one ingredient in paint thinners. It is the number one ingredient. It is a toxin that affects every organ in our body. And we need to understand that we choose to do that, and we talk about health and doing what's good for ourselves. And so it's like, okay, as long as we're educated on that, as long as we acknowledge that and we know how it affects us. But I find that very ironic.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really love how you're taking the tradition and then you're also reflecting on it and taking what's good about it and, you know, making it personalized to your own life. And I think that's really a beautiful thing about religion. And I love your perspective
Thank
on this.
You, Alex.
To kind of change it a little bit, mm-hmm. I've got another question. So we touched on this a little bit earlier, but kind of the role of God, like what role God plays in recovery. And this might be a tougher question to kind of get at, but do you think it's possible to recover from addiction without a belief in this higher power? And like, as you mentioned, surrendering yourself to a higher power.
Yeah, so unequivocally, yes. So let me just start by saying there are 20 plus million people, adults in the United States, who identify as being in recovery 5 years or more from having a substance use disorder. Statistically, a large portion of them don't have faith in God, and yet they are in recovery. And again, that comes to how do we define recovery? Is recovery synonymous with abstinence, sobriety, being clean? We can talk about what does recovery mean? So I can choose not to drink alcohol, so I'm abstinent. But recovery to me is more about rather than filling that, hole that we talked about earlier in myself, rather than filling my desperate need for meaning or connection or wholeness with something that's going to hurt me or hurt others, I'm going to learn how to deal with life on life's terms by responding to life in the healthiest possible ways I can, which means I need to learn new skills. I need to learn new tools. I want to walk this earth in a way that I don't ever want to cross the street if I see somebody because I don't want to address them. To me, that means I need to clean something up. So recovery as a model or as a framework is far more than just not using harmful substances. Far more than not just using harmful substances. It's about recovering our ability to walk with integrity, with purpose, with meaning. And again, each one of us gets to define that for ourselves. So for me, God plays a large part. But for somebody else, God can play no part. And I cannot judge that person. That's their truth. That's their experience. And that is wonderful. If they can find a way to walk this earth with full integrity and meaning without a God, wonderful. As long as we respect each other, right? It's, I think we get into problems when we think, I know the only path and my path is this, and you must do as I say. And that's why, you know, we talked earlier about AA or 12 steps. It won't work for somebody who doesn't want to embrace a higher power. Again, it doesn't need to be God. But one of the components of the 12 steps is we realize we are powerless. Our life is unmanageable. We realize that that we can be restored to sanity and that God can and we can't. So let's let God, which means we turn our lives over to God. Well, again, the word God is God of our understanding. For some people, it just is, what does that mean? It can just mean, look at the wisdom in this room. There are 150 people who do not use substances anymore. This is the God of my understanding. There is wisdom here. So I will believe that all of these people have more wisdom than I do as an individual. And so I will turn my life over. What does that mean? I'm going to follow suggestions, have willingness, have humility, learn a new way. It doesn't mean I'm prisoner to somebody. It actually means I have freedom because I'm not prisoner to thinking I know best.
I absolutely love that. You've kind of talked a little bit about this 12-step program, and that's particularly like interesting to us with the idea that it's a prayer written by a Protestant theologian. The 12 steps are, yes, you know, a secular agnostic system. And then you bring in the fact that, yes, when we say the word recovery, that doesn't mean the same thing all the time. I'm kind of wanting to know if this reference to a God, a universal God, a God of our understanding, do you think that is kind of the piece missing, maybe not for just recovery from one certain thing, but for, you know, that self-actualization, you know, achieving your goal? Do you think that connecting to your spirituality in, mm-hmm, a certain way is kind of the thing, mm-hmm, that's missing with people who might be,
yeah,
going around,
yeah, that's a great
going
question,
through
Alex.
Life lost?
I absolutely do think so. And before we touched on what Work at Health offers in our programs, when I was working as a consultant and going into treatment centers, I look at 8 dimensions of wellness, and spirit is one of those. Emotion is one of those. So what does it mean, spirit? Let's just stay there, right? We can know what the other, physical, emotional, financial, and so forth. So spirit can be the experience of awe and what brings awe to your life, and the ability to maybe be in nature or watch a sunset or see the waves crashing or see a baby born or, you know, see horses galloping. It's that ability to get in touch with this greater nature and to pause and to realize that what my individual aspiration is might not be the most significant thing in this world. And so it's a way to put life into perspective. And I think that's essential for recovery. But again, that's, you're asking Faye. I do not speak for my organization or any recovery program. I just think that one of the things that I've learned is, how do we differentiate between health, wellness, and well-being? And we often use those terms synonymously. And what I've learned is, health is the absence of illness. Wellness is the actions I take to be healthy. And I look at my health, the absence of illness in each of these different areas. My finance, my emotional life, my environmental life, my occupational life. You know, we can go through, and anybody can Google what are the 8 dimensions. And well-being is the balance, how I feel based on where I am balanced in all of these areas. So I might say I'm in debt financially, but if I look at the other area, first of all, I'm not in debt. I'm so happy to share. I was, and now I'm not. But one can be in debt, and as students, we know what that's like. And one can even be out of work, but they can still have another 6 elements six dimensions that are working well, and they can still have a sense of well-being. It's like that question of what's the difference between being healed versus not being ill, right? One is a spiritual, we can have a spiritual malady that's resolved versus an illness that might kill us, and we can still be healed.
Thank you again. You know, we keep saying, but we're learning so much from you. And you teach me every single time we talk, but I didn't quite expect it to feel this inspiring. So my mind was just running while you were speaking, and there are so many things. But I guess one theme that I'm picking up from you is that it doesn't need to be God of my understanding doesn't need to be this like one reductionist conception of this higher power, but it's the action of recognizing that I am not the center of the universe that starts you on this journey to recovery. And that's really cool because that also applies to every single person on this earth recovering from something, even if it's, you know, believing that they're like the most important thing ever.
And right? there's a component of it also is not only am I not the center of the universe, but I alone am nothing. And so let me join with, let me find my community. Mm-hmm. Community is an essential part of recovery. And it's an essential part of wellness or well-being that we must belong. Belonging is so important. People who suffer are often isolated.
I'll just share briefly that one particular philosophical interest of mine is Martin Heidegger, whose kind of thesis in Being and Time is that authentic being is resolute being towards death, meaning that recognizing that I am alone in this life and that I'm going to die alone. And kind of I took this Heidegger class through the lens of Judaism, and the response to that is actually no. That the opposite of resolute being towards death is recognizing that you are a part of a greater collective. And I'm just like hearing what you're saying through that lens, surrendering to that collectivism that I'm a part of this universe. And
that is also where religion for me has to do with time, like in history. Like I am part of this collective, which is historical and into the future. And with my spirituality, it's in this moment of for all time, with all time. It's not about history. It's not linear. Does that make sense? And
so you're saying that spirituality is related to presence and that for you, religion allows you to form constellations with all parts of time, which inherently takes you out of the present.
That's right.
That is so cool. And that's the balance of those things, maybe we can say, is spiritual or religious well-being. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, that's
we need
really
both,
cool.
Right?
We have another thesis to...
if you're always... Yes. Many of us. I don't want to
say
for
us. Everyone. Many of us do.
But what you know, if you're always present, then you're not...
Right. There's a need for alternation. Absolutely. With everything. You know, to get a different perspective, we can come back, we can take a break, we can sleep, we can wake. We, you know, there is a need for alternation.
Yeah. And I think just bringing it back to another, you know, kind of religious theme and learning about, you know, different religions all around the world, there's this thought in African religions, this word Ubuntu, which means I am because we are. And I kind of feel that is kind of what you're coming across. And the switching back and forth, the individual life and surrendering to the collective, I think that kind of beautifully encapsulates that because you find meaning for yourself in the collective.
One of the things that I find really challenging, now I grew up in the 80s and certainly in this country, and where the drive is be all you can be, stand out, be special, accomplish. And in recovery, I've learned be in the center of the pack. Learn to be a worker among workers. And it was like, wait, what? But I'm so special. So what does, and then how do I bring that into my professional life? well, if I'm a person in recovery and I have aspiration, does that mean I'm trying to stand out and stand apart? And does that put my recovery at risk? You know, and so that's why I have a sponsor, which is like my spiritual advisor through my recovery program. That's why somebody might have a rabbi. It is to seek out wisdom from others to guide our choices, because we get in, at least I get into danger when I think I know.
The fact that you just brought up your cultural upbringing, the time that you were brought up, reminds me of what you were saying earlier about how you had experienced trauma growing up and had unpacked that. And that that is one of the influences on your, you know, journey through life that, you know, you lent on substance to deal with that. But now that you're attuned to that upbringing, the time that led you to believe certain things, and that reflection is admirable. Yes. Like, we should all be doing that to some extent. And, you know, so thanks for
teaching. Well, I think one of the things about college is it's an opportunity to pause and reflect and say, am I who I am because it is absolute? Or did I inherit this from my family and I choose it? Like, what can I choose and what do I just accept? And therefore, what can I change? And so for me, okay, I grew up in this family, so I'm automatically a Democrat. Well, is that true? Or I'm automatically a liberal. Is that true? I mean, I need to investigate for myself these truths.
To bluntly switch the segue. Just ask an explicit question.
Yes.
Is addiction a spiritual illness? Or is it a mental illness? And what is the difference between those things? And if it's neither of those things,
how do you classify addiction? Who you go to for the answer, that you will get a different answer. So if I went to the medical community and they would say addiction is a disease of the brain, and there is a range of severity. If we go to a spiritual leader, they will say it's a spiritual malady. If we go to, you know, so again, it's from which lens are we going to approach it? I believe, like many other things, it is a combination, like many other illnesses, in fact, there are a combination of components where there are environmental factors and there are hereditary factors and there are spiritual factors. So what we want to do is we want to, and again, I come back to these eight dimensions, we want to investigate that we have health tools, the ability to cope, resiliency skills in all of those areas. For me, it absolutely was a spiritual malady. It absolutely was a spiritual malady, which didn't mean it didn't have a component of physiological dependence. That was real. But the solution wasn't a pill. The solution for me was an act of faith. And so it literally changed my biology. How does that work? I don't know. It's not important for me to ask. You know, that asking why is not a spiritual question. So that's one of the reasons I started saying those Christian prayers, is other people said it really works. And I said, well, who am I to say it doesn't? I'm willing to say it doesn't make me Christian. And so I started to say these prayers when I was in these recovery groups, and I felt part of, and I thought maybe I'm supporting somebody else's recovery, and it gave me joy, and it helped me recover. So.
Wow. Did you want to join?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely beautiful. And kind of calling back this metaphor that you've used throughout the podcast of in the time of, you know, recovery, you want to take what you're addicted to. And when that, you know, when
That's
you
right.
take that out of your life, there's kind of this hole. And one thing I remember growing up, we had a sermon based on this in church. And they said that, you know, when you take something away, there is this hole. And if you don't fill it up with something else, you know, something positive, then that's kind of where
that's right.
a lot of you know, our troubles come from, because, you know, you can call it the devil, you can call it evil, you can call it so many different things. Can you talk a little bit about how you kind of use that methodology, you know, replacing things, making sure that there's not this, you know, vacuum where, you know, potential things that are going to hinder you, you and your self-actualization.
It's such an important point you make. I was thinking about the Will Smith incident at the Oscars. And he talked about the devil coming to get you when you're in a high place. And the question is, what came over him in that moment that he couldn't control himself? And in that moment, he felt justified to stand up and go, you know, assault another person. What we learn, hopefully all of us learn, but what I have come to learn in recovery is to find freedom in the pause. And we have to cultivate the pause between the trigger and our reaction to the trigger. So if I'm hurting and my trigger, what happens is our amygdala gets hijacked, you know that, and then we will react as an animal. And that's what we saw happen. If he had, and again, I can't speak really for Will Smith, I don't know anything, but I'm just saying theoretically, if he had cultivated a spiritual practice that had allowed him to expand his ability to pause in discomfort, that would have allowed him to come back to the prefrontal cortex, recognize his vulnerability, reach out for connection, and to become part of again. The vulnerability piece is essential. Imagine Will Smith in that moment, instead of getting up on stage and slapping another man, if he had turned to his wife and said, "That was so painful. I am so sorry to hear him make a joke of you. I feel helpless." You know, there is humanity in that. And what he demonstrated was not humanity, right? So, you know, I think it's Viktor Frankl who said in Man's Search for Meaning, it is in that space where we find freedom. And so that's how a man like that can survive the Holocaust, Nelson Mandela in prison. Freedom in our mind. How do we cultivate freedom in our mind? Through a spiritual practice. So that God-sized hole that I was, you know, pouring alcohol into, I had to fill it up with God. And for me, that had to do with learning all this that I've learned in recovery so that I can pause and not react to life, but respond.
One book that I've been
reading
recently is The Power of Habit.
And
it talks about addiction.
Yeah.
And how, you know, we have cues and then some sort of action and then some sort of reward. And
that's right.
I think probably, you know, maybe what this book is getting at is that we all have these cues, which is a little bit of emptiness. And then the reward is kind of filling that emptiness.
Yes.
And it can be some sort of substance or an expression of violence, et cetera, et cetera. And the question is, how do we change the action or the pathway to get that reward in a way that's healthy for us? So you just applying that framework to what you're saying, I think is also
interesting. Also, you know, do you know of Johann Hari? Okay, so he wrote a book, and I'll see, I can maybe send it to you later, but he also has a TED Talk called "Everything You Think You Know About Addiction is Wrong." And he talks about belonging, that the opposite of addiction isn't recovery. The opposite of addiction is belonging, because he talks about we are going to fill that emptiness by creating some kind of, adapting some kind of connection, whether the connection is to alcohol or the connection is to prostitution or the connection is to relationship, that we need a sense of connection and belonging. And so he looked at how certain countries treat people who have addiction by either incarcerating and punishing them or isolating them like we do in this country, or like in Portugal, where they take all that money and they put it towards reconnecting individuals into community, work programs, housing programs, skills, and so forth. And that, anyway, it's well worth the watch.
Yeah, I love that. And coming from kind of a neuroscience perspective, I also am studying neuroscience here and along with religion. And there's a famous experiment they always talk about.
Yes, exactly.
With rat park.
That's it.
So they have these, for anyone listening who doesn't know, it's these rats who, you know, if they're put in a cage, you know, with nothing but the opportunity to have an addictive drug, then they're going to overdose themselves because they have nothing else to do. But if you take a similar population of rats and put them in an enclosure with like the utopia for rats or something, you know, like a bunch of toys, a bunch of, you know, enrichment, things like that, and you still give them the opportunity with those drugs, they don't take them. So it's kind of that meaning.
Yes,
that
we need to change our cage.
That I really love. yes, absolutely.
Wanted to ask a fun question or so to speak. I know another podcaster did this in a similar way. But if you had a shirt that represented you, how would it look? What would it say? What would be on it? And what kind of message would you want to give to the world?
I mean, I wish I could say something about love, but the shirt that I have made, and I did this when I was working at the National Council on Alcoholism, was F Stigma. F Stigma. And, you know, I am a woman who is in a same-sex marriage. I am an alcoholic in recovery. I am a divorcee. I am a Jew. There's a lot of otherness in these different elements of my identity. And if I were afraid of what people thought of me, I would crumble and die. But instead, by getting over the stigma and having a bold shirt that says, you know, F Stigma, it's actually an invitation for conversation. And for me, it's all about let's connect, let's have conversation. And so I so appreciate you two inviting me to have this one.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate this conversation. It's been so much better than I could even ever imagine.
Thank you.
So thank you so much.
We talked a lot about Alex being a Christian, me being a Jew, thinking about how our respective faith backgrounds would play into this conversation, how yours might and did. But I think that what you taught us was pretty universal. And obviously deeply resonant for me, I know for Alex as well. So thank you. I'm sure that, you know, whoever's listening to this is going to be super appreciative of you as we are. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.